Welcome to The Grand Conversation, the Machon Siach podcast. Machon Siach at SAR High School, honoring the memory of Belda Kaufman Lindenbaum, Zichrona Livracha, is the research arm of SAR High School, where faculty bridge theory and practice on matters of Jewish education, curriculum, and culture. I'm your host, Shmuel Hain, Rosh Beit Midrash at SAR High School. Our producer is Avi Bloom, and our engineer in the recording studio today is Greg Schmidt. We are recording this podcast exactly 3 weeks before Election Day in this presidential election year. On today's Grand Conversation, we are going to discuss what we have been doing at SAR High School to foster an environment where members of our community, and especially students, can engage in political discussion with civility and respect. My guests today are Rabbi Jonathan Kroll, principal of SAR High School, and Dr. Rivka Press-Schwartz, associate principal of SAR High School and part of the Machon Siach leadership team. Rabbi Kroll and Dr. Schwartz are part of the Faculty Election Committee, along with Dr. Judith Ballin, Rabbi Kenny Birnbaum, Rabbi Natty Helfgott, and Ms. Adina Schulzen. Welcome back, John and Rivka, to the Grand Conversation.
Thank you, Shmuel.
Great to be here.
So before we talk about 2024 and what we were doing in the school in advance of this election, I'd like to go back to a moment in time that feels like it was about 100 years ago, the election of 2012. You may recall, on the Thursday before that year's presidential election between President Obama and Senator Romney, we organized an after-school mishmar program with Yeshiva University, where our students first learned Jewish sources on the importance of civic engagement and voting with SAR alumni who were at the time students at Stern and Yeshiva College. And that was followed by a debate between Rabbi Reuben Gober, the Romney rep, and Dr. Schwartz, the Obama rep, that I moderated. It was an incredibly successful program, well-attended, educational, spirited. And the following week, Dr. Schwartz had her annual Return for the Returns program on election night, which was also very well-attended. And I remember thinking then, as a relatively new teacher in the school, how remarkable it was that the school had such a strong culture of engagement with politics, including from a Jewish lens. So my first question is for you, Rivka. Did the school or did you consciously do anything in those early years to build that robust culture? How was that culture even created?
You know, I don't think it's the case that we did something in particular to cultivate a student body that was more engaged in American politics. I think in general, we had a student body that was very highly engaged then. And I think that, well, the way I read it, I'm sure there would be some people who'd read it as, you know, kids these days, they're too busy on their Snapchat and their Instagram. I really don't read it that way. I read it that there was a particular moment in time in the life of SAR High School. We were a new school. Kids had a sense that they were in on the ground floor getting to build and shape something. Administrators and teachers could cultivate very close relationships with individual students because the school was just smaller. Not to say the teachers don't have close relationships with individual students right now, of course, but I think there was much more of a sense of students really participating in building and shaping something. And I think that gave them a sense that their voice matters. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a random example out of the blue here. Their first junior class in the spring of 2006, there was a massive rally on the National Mall in Washington. Not the kind of rally that we went to last November about Israel, but a rally about an issue that you would think would be much less close to a bunch of New York Jewish students' hearts. And that was about what was going on then in Darfur, in Sudan, and the murders of people that were going on there, of civilians, and rallying for the sake of Darfur. And we took our whole 11th grade, which was then the oldest grade in the school, on bus rides down to D.C. to go to a Darfur rally. And to us, the faculty, and to the students, that seemed like a perfectly reasonable and normal thing to do. And so somebody else might disagree with me and might say there's been a general devolution in levels of engagement or investment. I think, by the way, our students' actions over the past year in terms of Israel has proven that's very much not the case. But I think a broad sense of we matter and our voice matters and our input matters and our participation matters was a function of being a younger school in which students really felt like they were building something from the ground up, and there was a broader and more general cultural participation. I also have to say, you alluded to it, and maybe we'll get there a little bit more. It was also more possible when the broader culture around the discussion of politics didn't feel so fraught and maybe even toxic. First of all, when in the Jewish community, politics and whom you voted for and supported felt like whom you voted for and supported, not like these are existential questions of threat to the United States and Israel, and if you vote the wrong way, you are undermining everything that. And so people either lean into that and engage in politics with a kind of vehemence and even vitriol that can be very off-putting to others, Or they pull back and they say, the last thing I want to do is talk to anybody about politics or how I engage in politics. And in both ways, I think that change in the broader climate and in the Orthodox community climate around politics and around how we do politics has driven people away from the kind of productive and thoughtful, but maybe also not super escalated engagement that you and I both remember from 2012.
John, turning to the present moment, is there any way within the context of both a larger school and the polarized moment in terms of American political, what can we do to foster a culture that's civically engaged, that's interested in politics, that can talk about those things without it devolving into this very polarizing kind of space?
I think we tried to be very intentional about that this year. As you mentioned earlier, we set up a committee. Over the summer, we began meeting, trying to set up a series of principles that we believe in, not just what we should avoid doing, but how should we positively, affirmatively talk with each other? How should we share our own values while respecting other people's values? How should we talk about the issues? And this is something that we're presenting to our students, we've been presenting to our students, both within the framework of their history classes, as well as within the broader theme of our school year this year. Our theme of the school year is Koach HaDibur, the power of speech, which we are talking about, you know, kind of civil conversation and how we use our words, having nothing to do with the election, but this fits in very nicely with that. So I actually think that kind of telling students what we expect of them is one of the most important things we do. Sometimes we take for granted that we think kids know how they're supposed to talk with each other, but why should they? Why should they think that they're supposed to do anything different than what they see on the news or on social media? What gets the most likes, what gets the most kind of attention is when somebody zings somebody else, when somebody makes a mistake and everybody laughs at it. And so, to a large extent, you know, broader cultural trends are pushing them in that direction. It's our job to, you know, really share with them what our expectations are. And I think the kids get that when you share it with them.
So in terms of trying to guide the conversation, they're like a set of guidelines for faculty that you have shared in terms of what faculty can discuss, what they should discuss, what they definitely should not discuss. I'll start with you, Rivka.
We really spent a lot of time thinking about this for all of the following reasons. There is an approach that says in order to keep calm and peace in schools, what you should do is simply pretend that an election is not happening. I actually mean that pretty literally, like as much as possible, we are not going to discuss this in class. Our history classes will talk about the Mexican-American War or the French Revolution, but they will not talk about what's going on all around us. And we really think as a matter of value that that is not the right thing to do, to just everybody be quiet and everybody don't bring it into school because it gets too escalated, too polarized, too toxic, is not the way we want to do this. And then we have to think about what are we saying about how to try to have conversations that get to something other than name calling and wherever else these conversations tend to get. And we want to create a space in which people can talk about the things that they value and care about. And so what we ended up saying to teachers was, we want teachers to talk about issues, and we want teachers to talk about values. We don't want teachers to talk about personalities or candidates or teams. Now, I just want to acknowledge that that is, of course, at some level, a distinction that you can't really maintain because those things overlap and blend into each other in many ways. But it is an ideal and a goal. So instead of talking about the identity or, for goodness sake, the appearance or the personal characteristics of a candidate, let's talk about what are the issues that matter to me in this election. Certainly, depending on what issues you advance as the issues that matter to you, it might be obvious to the kids whom you're voting for, but let's keep the conversation at a level of these are the values that are motivating me in this election. These are the issues that I care about. So that's what we said to teachers. We said to teachers, we should absolutely be talking about this. We should be talking about issues we care about. We should be talking about values that motivate us. We should be talking about how we think about this as Americans and as Jews. What we shouldn't be doing is participating in Rabbi Kroll just referred to as the ha 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 ha, did you see the stupid thing this person said, the dumb thing this person did, ha ha, they made this gaffe, ha ha, here's an opportunity to make fun of their appearance or the way they fumbled that word or whatever else It is, because that is the kind of the sugar high, the instant rush of eating an Airhead. But, you know, your stomach starts to hurt after too much of that.
Speaking of Airheads.
That was a great segue, John. I don't know where you're going, but that's an outstanding segue.
I have no idea where I'm going to go that would be civil. So I'm just going to pause there and say, imagine what I would say next. I think it's important to recognize a couple of different things. One of them is we're not just talking about how teachers talk to their students. We're also talking about teachers talk to each other. A big part of what the kind of what the school culture is based on is how teachers feel about their own work environment, how it is that they're managing life in school. And teachers come to school not just to teach. They're also part of a community, part of a collegial environment where they're spending time in the teacher's room, spending time around the water cooler, spending time on the copy machine at lunchroom, talking with each other and sharing ideas, not only about their craft and what they're teaching, but also about what's going on in their lives, what's going on in the world. And one of the questions that we had to ask ourselves was, what sort of guidelines are we giving teachers about how to talk about the election? Because for all the classes that they teach, we can give guidelines about what they should be doing in class. Should we be giving teachers guidelines about how to talk with each other in the teacher's room? Is that appropriate? Is that like sort of like, you know, restricting them in a way that infantilizes conversation? Or is it something that you do in order to kind of free up conversation and remove certain, like, you know, anxieties around what you're supposed to and not supposed to say? So we actually talked with our staff about this, and we came up with some, you know, particular guidelines. One most important thing is not to assume that you know who your colleague is voting for. Don't walk into the teacher's room and assume that everybody's voting for the person who you want to vote for. And then all of a sudden, there's somebody who's not voting for your candidate, and they feel like they're on the outs. So that's like a really important thing that we share with our teachers, and our teachers bought into that. They're not forbidden from sharing with each other who it is they will vote for. There's no, you know, canvassing going on in the school. We don't want to tell them they're not allowed to share with their colleagues who they might vote for if they'd like to do that, but you should not expect that somebody else is voting a particular way. That's really important. And I would say, I would contrast that with what we said to teachers about how they're supposed to talk to kids in their classroom about who they're voting for. We told teachers, we have part of the committee that we mentioned earlier, came up with this sort of policy, which is to say that teachers should not tell their students who they're voting for. It's not appropriate. Not because we're worried that a teacher is going to say something that is offensive in the classroom, but there's a certain power dynamic in the classroom. And if a teacher says that they're voting for one particular candidate, it makes other kids in the class feel that if they think differently, they might have a perception that their teacher is going to view them differently. We don't want kids to feel that way.
I'll add to that, in talking about teachers not talking about whom they voted for, that in writing out these principles, the work of the election committee, we made, again, a very clear choice not to frame that as don't tell kids who you're voting for so that you don't, but to frame it in terms of a positive value. I think John said this earlier. We don't want this to be a list of don'ts. We want this to be positive civic and Jewish values that we hold. And so in this case, the positive civic value is that in the United States, we have a secret ballot. Until the 19th century, that was not the case. Until the 19th century, you went to vote at the county courthouse, and everybody could see your vote cast and recorded. Everybody knew whom you were voting for. And obviously, that created, talk about power dynamics, that created all kinds of social pressures. All your neighbors knew whom you were voting for. And the idea of a secret ballot, actually was called originally the Australian ballot, so I guess we got it from Australia, the Australian ballot, which is a secret ballot. Nobody has the right to know whom you're voting for. And that's to protect everybody from fear and from pressure and from repercussions. Your vote is between you and, I don't know what, the ballot booth, the electoral booth, the Constitution. So now I'm going to tell a story that John and Shmuel have both heard me tell many times, but I'm going to tell it again anyway. I grew up in New York City. In New York City, those of you who are old New Yorkers like me, remember we used to have the coolest voting booths. We got rid of them now with these like little bubble sheet optical scan ballots that are no fun. But we used to have the coolest voting booths that were manual. And so you would flick little levers towards whichever candidate you wanted. And then there was one giant lever that at the end you pushed to record your vote and clear all your selections. And then the next person could come in and flick all the levers. And that giant lever went like ka-thunk chunk when you pushed it. It was a lot of fun.
That's precisely the alliteration. That's what it was. It was a ka-chunk-thunk.
Kathunk chunk.
Is it Kathunk chunk? Or
if you grew up in Chicago, you don't know from such
I'm
things.
Familiar with these things. I did it when I my earlier years living in New York, in Chicago. I don't think I ever voted in Chicago, actually.
Just the dead people in the cemeteries voted
multiple
in Chicago.
Times.
Early and often, yeah. But I think it was a Kathunk chunk. I did experience that.
So I remember going as a kid with my mother to vote. And my mother would go into the little voting booth. It was kind of like a shower curtain you pulled closed behind you so you could vote. And then Kathunk chunk. Kathunk thunk. And I
sure.
wanted to go in with my mother and push the lever because that certainly sounded like fun. I did finally, when I was old enough to vote, get to vote that way myself for a
briefly.
Few years before they switched over to the optical scan ballot. And my mother wouldn't let me come into the voting booth with her. She wouldn't let me come into the shower curtain where she chose her candidates. And my mother said, if this sounds to you like, you know, a cold or cruel thing, my mother said to me that in the United States, we have a secret ballot and your vote is private and nobody gets to know who you voted. And that actually had a huge impact on me as a lesson about civics, not a lesson about my mother leaving me out, but as a lesson about civics, that your vote is something private that nobody else gets to know about. The other thing that's interesting about this story is that, of course, now, given the way our society lands, there are very few people that you go to the polling booth with them and you actually don't know how they're going to vote. But at a time when things didn't seem to be quite as predictable and polarized and lined up according to team, I could actually not know how my mother was going to vote in those elections. And so I think asserting or articulating affirmative civic values for our kids, again, not just these negative values, don't talk about it because it'll make disagreement or it'll make trouble. Don't talk about whom you're voting for because it will get students riled up or what parents riled up or whoever it'll get riled up. But instead to say, let's have an affirmative value of civil discourse, even in talking about things that divide us. Let's have an affirmative value of respecting the secret ballot, even as we talk about election issues. And you're right, you might be able to surmise from my conversations about election issues how I plan to vote in this election.
So I want to push both of you on the guidelines and a little bit on the space between telling students outright who you're voting for and the secret ballot and the positive value that that's associated with that. Do you think there is a space for a teacher bringing themselves into a classroom, whether it's a Judaic studies teacher, a history teacher, a science teacher, to talk in class about how their values, their Jewish values, or maybe their broader ethical values animates and informs their perspective on this election or on the parties? Or is that a line that's too far to getting into who you're voting for?
I would say, I think it's a complex question. I don't think it's obvious. I think that the when it becomes clear who you are voting for, you lose the conversation, because then it turns into, just because this is the nature of the electoral season we are in now, which is, it's really about playing for teams. It's a sport, is what it feels like. And I think that as soon as a student knows who I said I'm planning on voting for, the conversation stops. You just don't have the conversation. I lament it. I wish it were different than what I'm describing. I just don't think it is different than what I'm describing. And therefore, I think if there's some kind of like authentic way in which the material that I'm learning in my Chumash class actually centers on a particular issue that is important in the election, I think it's appropriate for a teacher to kind of talk about that and unpack that. I think it is, you know, if a teacher walks into their Chumash class and says, as a, you know, thinking American who's also a Chumash teacher, I want to tell you why the following issue is really important to understand what the biblical view is on this matter. And it becomes very clear that the person is either voting for one side or the other, then I don't think there's a place for that. You know, if it flows authentically from the material that you're learning, great. If it feels to the student like a teacher is coming in to share their political views on the matter, I don't think it's a smart idea, and I would be against that.
This is, as John said, it's a very complicated question, because any bright line you draw is right away going to fall apart. Because you could say teachers shouldn't make their views obvious to their kids. If I'm a teacher and I walk into class and I say, the most important value to me in the election is protecting unborn human life, or the most important value to me in the election is protecting a woman's right to choose, you know which candidate I'm voting for based on those two statements, even though I've said nothing about tribe or team, and I'm only talking about values and ideas, which I think teachers should be free to talk about. And let's say I don't do that. Let's say I talk in a class about the range of economic policies from pure capitalism with no regulation to pure socialism. And I say there are trade-offs. And my position is that the government should tax more in order to provide more benefits to poor Americans. Or my position is that the government should cut taxes on the wealthiest Americans to enable them to reinvest in the economy and create jobs. Again, just from those statements about pure policy statements, you really do, in fact, know whom I am voting for. And so I don't think it's really possible to say to teachers, you shouldn't give away unless, and this is a perspective that some teachers have. It takes a very, very skilled teacher to do this. I cannot. There is a teacher who is like a complete blank slate and mirror, and I only ask you probing questions to elicit your own deeper thinking about your positions, and I never in any way tip my hand or betray what I am thinking about any of this. And you sometimes encounter teachers who can do this, but if you can't, I actually think it's better to be transparent about what my position is so students know that and can critique it. On this question of where we land on economic policy, here's where I land, and here's somebody else who lands someplace different, and it's fair game for you to think the way I do or to think differently, as opposed to pretending I don't have a point of view, but really figuring out how to work my point of view into the conversation. The place, and John sort of brought this up, but it is also explicitly in our principles, where I think this gets very dangerous is when we roll this into the realm of religion. And one of our principles, our last principle, adopted from something that Professor Jerome Chanis once wrote, is that Torah is neither Republican nor Democratic, it is Torah. And what that means is if you take Torah and you pull apart the values encoded in the Torah, they do not line up 100% with the platform of either major American political party right now. There are things that the Torah talks about that are more Democratic and things that the Torah talks about that are more Republican. And we, as observant Jewish voters, are making choices about what we are prioritizing over what. Or we're saying, I care about Israel in this way, and so I'm going to yield on some other value that's also important to me because it's not as important as that. Or I care about this other issue, and that's going to over. At the end of the day, we don't see there being the Torah tells you to vote for this party kind of position. And we are very leery of having that presented to our students that way for a lot of reasons. So I think there's a very big difference between the teacher saying, my personal Jewish values or Torah values lead me to this particular balancing act or this particular weighing and measuring, and a teacher saying, the Torah mandates that you vote for X.
Can I just say, I think that, you know, I'm not so sure that there'd be so many teachers that the kids in the class would necessarily know who it is that they're voting for. I think that the majority of teachers in our school, kids would walk into the class and say, who do you think they're voting for? I'm not sure. Someone would say this, someone would say that. I think there are a number of teachers. It usually comes up in history classes, I think, where students can have a little bit better of a sense of where someone's politics lie because history deals with politics much more than physics or calculus does. And therefore, I think for the vast majority of teachers in the school, kids really don't know who they're voting for. And I'll be honest, I have no idea. I think the humility, as we said, we're encouraging teachers to have when they walk into their teacher's room to say, I don't know who it is that my colleagues will vote for, is not only a, you know, sort of a veneer of pretending that you don't know, but you really do know. I don't know who most teachers are voting for. I think it's very complex.
I actually think that's a great thing to model for our kids. Getting back to, there isn't just one clear answer. Somebody might say, okay, I'm just going to give the examples that I'm giving because I think it's helpful, right? Two different examples cutting in opposite directions. One example is that you're seeing a number of prominent Republicans come out and say they're voting for Harris in this election because whatever their Republican conservative political commitments are, they believe that in this election it's important to vote for Harris. And you are also seeing a number of Jews who might have many policy positions that are more left-leaning who are saying, despite whatever my Democratic political commitments might be, I'm voting for Trump in this election because at the end of the day, I think that's a better position to take for Israel, and that's how I'm voting. So the fact that you know how somebody stands on a number of issues, I keep saying so that you can know how they're voting, but actually in this election, you might not know how they're voting because there are, again, these weighings and measurings and prioritizings, and there are a lot of values I hold, and there isn't a party that exactly lines up with every single thing that I think. And at the end of the day, it is a binary choice. I go into the voting booth, and I can only vote for one or the other. Please don't tell me about third-party candidates who have no chance of becoming president. I can only vote for one or the other, and I am going to have to, at the end of the day, choose. So I do think that that is true and probably truer in this election than it's been in both directions, where people might be voting against their more generally understood policy preferences because of what they think is important in this election. And even, you know, even granting that, I do think, as John said, it, you know, can be very different with different teachers. I'm not just a history teacher. I'm an American politics and government teacher. So I'm talking about these things all the time, the issues that would directly implicate which political positions you have. I certainly agree that there are fields in the school where it doesn't necessarily come up directly in class and where it might be more opaque to students.
I want to ask one last question. I think this is relevant beyond the election or in the immediate aftermath of the election. I think in 2016 and 2020, some students felt that it was after the election when they saw teachers' reactions to who won or who lost the election that they felt a sense of alienation or that sense of politics intruding into the classroom learning experience. Has the election committee thought about the day after, the weeks after, and especially if the weeks after are contested, which it appears they very well may be, how are we going to navigate those moments when we need to teach civics and we need to teach government and politics, even as real life events are swirling around and teachers feel impacted by that?
So I think there are two separate things there, and we should talk about them separately. The first is that, yes, especially after the 2016 election and heading into 2017, it felt like not just we, the faculty and SAR, but the whole country was in this reaction mode. Donald Trump had been elected president and then sworn in, and every day was like, what happened today and what was being posted on Twitter, and there was a lot of reacting. And that did not serve us well. That instantaneous reaction to what I saw today did not serve us well institutionally, and it probably didn't serve us well more broadly in American politics. The responding to what I saw this second on Twitter doesn't actually turn out to be a considered way to engage with a president, a platform, a policy. And so we, especially in the history department, have done a lot of work about what does it mean to kind of take a step back, think things over, digest, and then bring into class that which is actually worth bringing into class and merits discussion in class instead of walking into class, looking at Twitter, right? It actually is a fascinating thing. Until the inauguration of Donald Trump in 2017, we never had a mechanism for finding out directly what the president of the United States was thinking about a whole host of things in real time. You got, you know, they did a press conference once every whatever. They put out a statement through an advisor. And all of a sudden, we had the president of the United States sharing his thoughts with the country and the world in real time. And it led us down a path of being reactive to that that did not serve us well, neither educationally nor communally. And again, there's been a lot of thinking about how to step back from that, from the moment-by-moment reactions, which again has now become everyone's mode to everything, as Rabbi Kroll said earlier. I see a four-second clip of something that's posted. I have no idea what happened before it or after it, and we're all. And so I think in general, institutionally, and again, especially as a history department, we've made a commitment to that stepping back, taking a breath, thinking about things overnight, figuring out what really merits a response and what doesn't merit a response. You know, the question of what do we have institutional statements or positions about, which I think that we wisely have avoided making institutional statements and positions in general about broad political issues that don't directly affect us and directly affect our community. So that's all one set of issues. The other set of issues, which again is implicated directly in our election principles, is that one of our election principles is that we accept the outcome of elections and that political violence has no place in our politics. And some might argue that that statement has a partisan valence. I don't think it does. At a time when former President Trump was the target of, you know, one very serious and one maybe less serious but still threatening assassination attempt, at a time when there have been all kinds of other threats and uses and talk of political violence, I think, and obviously when on January 6th of 2021 we saw political violence directed against, you know, attempted to be directed to prevent the certification of an election. So we've seen political violence in all kinds of directions, and that is, you can't have a democracy. You can't have a democracy at the point of a gun. You just can't. That's like the sine qua non of having a functioning democracy is that we all think we could do this thing without getting killed. If we can't do this thing without getting killed, then we can't do this thing. And so I think it's different to say, how are we responding to political events that happen in a thought through and considered and take a breath and slow down way, which is different than saying, articulating a very clear position to our kids that whoever wins the election and however you feel about it, that violence is not how we resolve things in this polity.
I was going to say, as well. There's something, you know, I think I've once heard somebody say, perhaps it was you, Rivka, that, you know, when we say to somebody, you can correct me if I'm wrong, if it wasn't you, we can attribute who it was. You know, you shouldn't, when you say sometimes to somebody, you shouldn't be running around like your hair is on fire, unless your hair actually is on fire. Did you once say that to me?
I might have once said that to you.
Okay. The, I think it's important for us to realize this is something about having a certain amount of confidence in the American system of government and in the history of America and the way that politics has worked and will continue to work, is that everybody in the school community, students, parents, teachers, whatever the results of the election are, and they're obviously going to be a large percentage of the country that is not going to be happy with the election. It's split very, very close right now, and I'm assuming that it's going to be similar to that at the on election day. At the end of the day, there's a certain confidence and belief in the values that America fosters, that we think that if your candidate who you wanted to win wins, that's great and terrific. And if your candidate loses, there's a certain confidence that the way the government will continue to go on and function in a way that's healthy, productive, and four more years, you want to vote that you want to change the party at the who's in the White House, then you can have that opportunity to do that in four years. And I think there's a certain, I think, educating around and messaging around that as not walking around like your hair is on fire, depending on what the, you know, outcome of the election is really important.
I would say something else, which is we've spent a year now talking about Achdut and talking about Kol Yisrael and talking about the Jewish people as one, and we sing lots of songs and we do lots of beautiful messaging and make nice videos about it. And then when it comes to American electoral politics, it's like we didn't really mean that so much. If you're a Jew and you're voting differently than I'm voting, you're not a Jew, or you're a terrible Jew, or you're a self-hating Jew, or you're an idiot, or you're something, or you're another. I really think that we have to do the hard work, and I think it is hard work, of saying that Kol Yisrael has to mean that we cannot be split into over American electoral politics in the year 2024. I'm sorry, the Jewish people has hung around a lot longer and survived a lot worse than very contentious American elections. And if we get to the point where we are really reading people out of the Orthodox community or reading people out of the Jewish community because their stances on American politics, then I think we have lost the plot. And I think that our odes to Achdut and our ode to Jewish unity and to Jewish peoplehood can't be something that we say in October 7th commemorations, but then we turn around and head to November 5th and we sort of lose sight of all of that. And I'm not pretending that that's easy. The issues that divide us are real and they are important. And people deeply believe, as John just said, that if the other candidate wins, really bad things are going to happen for America, for Israel, for my community, for other communities. People really deeply believe that. And I'm going to say, and yet, we have to hold on to the belief that what holds us together as a Jewish community is bigger than even the most important issues that divide us. Otherwise, I do not know what we're doing here. We are a tiny American Jewish population as part of a tiny global Jewish population, and we're now going to split ourselves in half over presidential candidates. Yeah, I don't really think that that is serving our broader interests here, even as I completely acknowledge and believe that the things at stake in this election matter a lot.
I was going to say that, you know, I think I've seen some of the data that have suggested that a major shift over the past 20 years or so in terms of how people think about potential spouses. I recalled, I don't know if Dr. Schwartz, you've seen the surveys, whether you could imagine yourself marrying somebody who holds a different political party as their party of choice. And that was not even an understandable question a couple of decades ago, maybe less than a couple of decades ago. But now it seems to be a very primary factor in thinking about who you'd see as a potential spouse. I think that it would be very, very sad and unfortunate if in the Jewish community that were to be the case. I lament the fact that our identities are shaped too strongly by partisan politics and not by that Achdut that you were talking about. As hard as it is to put that aside, the and yet, I think it's something we really have to strive for. The messaging needs to be about the Achdut and the Klal Yisrael much more than the partisan bickering.
And I will say something else, which is And we should try to get past, again, just the red team, blue team, my slogan, your slogan. When we're talking about the deep values and deep questions of governance and policy and everything else that are going on here, those are real questions. And we as educators should be educating towards that. And it's okay. It's good. It's what we should want for our students to have strong feelings about that and feel invested in it and care about the outcome for American democracy. So it's not that what we're educating towards is we should see ourselves as members of Klal Yisrael and we don't care about these things. We're members of Klal Yisrael and we care about these things. And at the end of the day, that cannot be something that tears our community in half. I hope it won't be.
Thank you, Rivka and John. And I hope 4 years from now, we're ready to host another debate like we did 12 years ago, and that the community and the American political discourse has moved in a way, and that hopefully what we're doing will contribute to that positive movement of focusing on the issues, focusing on the values, focusing on the positive statements rather than on the tearing down and the negative statements. Thank you, John and Rivka, for participating in this really important conversation. And thank you for listening to this episode of The Grand Conversation. Please be sure to look at the episode notes for the statement of principles that we formulated for this election, and visit our website, www.machonsiach.org, where you can subscribe to our podcast and find all of our work, essays, papers, newspaper columns, and podcasts on a variety of subjects. Until next time, this has been The Grand Conversation, the Machon Siach Podcast.